Everyone, my book is named called Fame, obviously, and I have these stickers. So someone's going to pass them out. I hope I have enough for everyone. Here. Oh, so weird. I'm mic'd everywhere I go. Okay.
Well, it gets the message across, you know?
Take a sticker. Microphone?
Yeah.
Yeah, take a sticker.
You want water? Or,
yeah. I'm good.
Okay, all right. So we can, I mean, we can cuss a little bit, even though we're in church, because it's Saturday.
God doesn't mind.
Okay? So everybody, Justine Bateman, I just want to give you some more information. She is a graduate of UCLA in computer science, right? She is a director and a writer, and she just happens to have been on a television show in the 1980s called Family Ties. So that's part of your world. And when I got this book, first of all, it was orange, and I like that color. But I got this book, I didn't know what to expect exactly. And I opened up the first page, and it said, memoirs. I fucking hate memoirs. I said, I'd like to read this. But what's interesting is, Justine, you've written a book that opens with that line, yet I think that it's not totally not a memoir. It's an idea book, and a great idea book about something we don't think about all that much, which is this meditation on fame. But you are in it, and there are moments from your reality that you bring in there. So explain to me a little bit about how you came up with the idea.
So respectfully, it's not a memoir. Because to me, a memoir is either an expanded Wikipedia of your Wikipedia entry of your life, or it's very, it's a, God, this is loud. It's a very specific account of some moment that happened in your life, like you were kidnapped or you survived a plane crash or something like this. Can this be turned down a little bit? Please, thanks. So what I did is I wanted to give the reader, the book is the life cycle of fame. From the beginning, then the equilibrium where everybody just knows you're famous, and then the descent. And the fame is leaving you, and then the without. And are you ever really without? Can you ever really not be famous again? And I wanted to emotionally time travel for the reader. So I really put myself back into what it felt at all of these stages. And these are stages that every famous person is going to go through. Maybe not the entire life cycle. Like Brad Pitt is going to go to this part of the life cycle, and then he'll work and work and work and work and become an old man and then pass away. He's never going to, I don't believe he'll ever come. Tom Cruise, same thing. But for me, I've done the entire life cycle. So in that sense, those moments may resemble entries in somebody else's memoir. But for me, they are almost like, it's like a empirical sociology, like, or investigative reporting. I am going in, I am time traveling back into those moments, and I'm telling the reader, this is what it's like, here's what I'm feeling right now, here's what's going on right now at all of these points in the life cycle. And really, any famous person is going to have gone through very similar experiences at least three of those points. And then there's also, though, so that's from the inside, and then from the outside, sociological theories of my own, and then, you know, established sociological theories that explain why the public behaves the way they do at different points in those life cycle. And I count myself as one of the members of the public, because I, too, am in front of fame at different points of their life cycle, and how do I react or not react during those points. And then, of course, it looks at our obsession with fame and how society has placed it on such a high pedestal now, and how detrimental I feel that is to us as a society.
I mean, you make a really good point in here about the connection or lack of connection between when you're good at something. I'm paraphrasing, you're a writer, yeah. So you know, I'm doing my best. But when you are good at something and creative and you're contributing, that can be the time when you're at your least famous, and when you have no self-awareness or no understanding of this larger world, that can be when you're most famous, which I think is very interesting.
Yes, and not only that, but there's, to me, there's two types of fame. There's an appreciation for somebody whose work, you know, you really admire. And then there's this frenzied fame, which is just, so the one is, oh, wow, I really enjoy that play I saw you in, or that book you wrote, or that film you directed, or whatever, and especially this one scene, or whatever. It's, they're coming up to you because it meant something to them. The other is, oh, my God, you're, what's your, just, can I take a picture with you? I mean, you know, my sister's a big fan, and just, or I'll just get it myself, and, you know, whatever. And you're just an object at that point. You're not, there's no, if there's an appreciation for the work during those moments, there's no acknowledgement of it. So, and the, knowing people for something that they've done that you like and enjoy, that's one thing, and that, that should continue. But the other, the frenzied fame, I feel is way out of proportion, and the desire to attain that is, I think, very, is sort of a virus we're contending with now. And social media has democratized that effort. Now everyone can get in on it. You don't even, it used, it was for a while there that, that reality shows democratized it, right? Because you didn't even have to, you didn't have to have any discernible skills or talents demonstrated. You were just going to be a contestant on a reality show and then wind up in a magazine and whatever. And then but social media has made it available, that pursuit available to everybody. You can get more followers, more subscribers, do something more outrageous, more...
Well, let me ask you something about social media, because I did, at my regular job, I'm at the Washington Post, where I write a lot of profiles of people, and I wrote a profile of Marc Maron. Guy is at the height of his career. He's got this podcast, he's playing sold-out shows, and on Twitter, some guy said something nasty about him, and the guy's name was like Tractor Driving Man or something, and he had like 9 followers, and yet Maron goes after him. And you also, I know you, what I want to say to him and I want to say to you is, don't do it. But if somebody says something nasty, you might respond, and it does get under your skin. How do you deal with the fact that you're a public person, really? You know, you're putting yourself out there, but, you know, these anonymous people are coming from everywhere, and they can say anything they want. You know, I want you to have a thicker skin about that and not attack them because they're so insignificant.
I appreciate your concern. when I happen to, first of all, what's going on in my opinion is when people, I talk about in the book how it used to be, used to take a lot more effort to comment to somebody whose work you like. You had to write a letter. You had to get some stationery, get a pen out, compose your thoughts, get it all down, put it in an envelope, get a stamp, get an address. Yeah, where are you going to send it, right? You can't go on the internet and find out what their address is, right? We're talking pre-consumer-facing internet. So you would maybe look up in the phone book or call Paramount Studios or NBC or wherever your star is, wherever this person is working. And you'd finally get it, and then you'd have to get yourself to the to a mailbox. And anyway, so I say, like, for every 100 people who wanted to do that, maybe only 5 got a, you know, got a letter into the mailbox, right, with all that effort, concerning all that effort. Now, with the internet, it's so much easier. You can just at any of these, you know, just have their handle in there, and they're likely to find it. And it can be great, and it can be bad. It can be great because you can, you truly can connect with people you admire and let them know that you like their work, and that's great. I've been able to do that with filmmakers I really like. But then it also makes it really easy for people to pop off, like you were saying.
The trolls can really come out from anywhere.
Well, and here's why, what I think is going on. I think there's a lot of loneliness out there, and seeing that there's all these conversations going on can even increase that feeling of loneliness. And the fastest way to get intimacy with another human being is to injure them. So it's what I call intimacy through injury. The fastest way to get a celebrity to respond to your post is to insult them. And a lot of these are people, and a lot of these accounts are bots. And so you mentioned my computer science background. If I were programming a bot, what I would do is I would have a certain threshold for number of followers. So I say, like, I'm going to go after all the accounts that have at least 200,000 followers. And then I'm going to take those names, and I'm going to put those in, and I'm going to find all the insulting things have been said to them, and the insulting things that got the most responses. Then I'm going to feed those into the algorithm, and I'm going to make sure that my bot is saying to those people above that threshold the most insulting things, because I know those things will get a response, right? Mm. It'll get under somebody's skin, get a response, and then what happens when you get that, when the celebrity will respond, people who are fans of this person's work will now come to their defense. So they start tweeting at this person now, or this bot now, and this bot that had 9 followers now has gotten a lot of attention. Then you've got another group of people that just like that intimacy through injury. They like to just go after the chum in the water. So maybe they weren't even in on the first attack, but now they're like, oh, it's happening. Somebody's attacking a celebrity. They're fighting back. This is all in the book. And so then they start maybe following. The whole thing is about gathering a following, right? So now they start following Tractor Joe Bot or whatever.
Tractor Pull Man.
So they start following, and then that's one of the, at least if I was coding it, that's one of the ways I would try to get more followers for these bots.
What a harsh reality.
But another, right? One of the reasons that I do respond sometimes is that certain ways that I'm being attacked online by the bots or by individuals are attacks that are similar to women my age or similar to actresses or similar to whatever. So sometimes I'll respond, and it's nice. Lately I've been able to respond with, well, Bob, that's interesting. I talk about you in my book. I recommend you grab a copy and let me know what you think after. So that's been a lot of fun with that. But yeah, sometimes you gauge it. You gauge it.
I watched one. I can't remember the exact exchange, but Sarah.
I mean,
Silverman,
I don't pull an Elon Musk. Let's put it that.
No, you that do not.
Way,
I agree.
Where he seems to spend an inordinate amount of time engaging people that want to fight with him, and maybe for him too. I don't want to speak for him, but maybe for him too, it feels like he's having an exchange with his community. You know,
yeah.
In a negative way, but maybe it feels like intimacy.
It just seems like it's a kind of a cold world at times with social media. And I, though I have, nowhere near the experience you have, but when I get angry letters or the phone call comes in and someone's angry, I try to diffuse it by being nice. And I usually find that people are so surprised that you responded that it brings them to a more peaceful place. I'm not into intimacy by, what was that?
Intimacy through injury.
Yeah, I don't like that.
It happens all the time, though. especially between men and women in the dating world, you know. There might be a pretty girl that lots of guys want to talk to, and then there's one guy who knows he doesn't really have a chance with her, and he might say, you know, I think she's got a big butt. Now, since he's the outlier, now the girl's like, he thinks I have a big butt? His name's Ricky. Ricky thinks I have a big butt? Now she's all about convincing Ricky she doesn't have a big butt. So now he's got a leg up on all the other guys. You see what I'm saying?
You write so beautifully about this situation on the red carpet, which I've only once been forced to cover the red carpet, but I was very scared that day because everybody's yelling at people. It's so strange to me. I couldn't talk to anyone because they were all yelling at them to turn left and to turn right. And Mr. Carell, you know, it was strange to me. But you write beautifully about the carpet, sort of on the moment where fame is ascending and the moment where fame is descending.
It's true.
And I would like you to, you have a little paper there?
Yeah. I sure do.
I would love for you to read a little bit to these fine folks about
it. So one of the things I talk about in the book is reality and how reality is established. And for a very small subset of people, fame becomes part of that reality. So I'm talking about the language you speak, the gender you are or want to be, the job you have, the city you live in, who your friends are, who your family is, where you live in a house or an apartment, whatever. And if any one of those things were to drop out, like your house catches fire, you know, knock wood, or any of the other things I said, it's a big adjustment. It's a big, it can be traumatic. And so for a really small group of people, fame is one of those things because naturally you start associating your self-esteem with it, your identity, your worth, where you fit in with society and all of that. So when that starts dropping out, all those things feel like they're being pulled away. You know, this glitter cloud of fame is moving on, and you have these tethers into you that are associated, attached to all those things I just mentioned, and you've got to start unhooking them. And so you discover that it's the fame is descending in different ways. And the thing, this part I'm about to read you, this is one of the ways that you find out that your fame is like sand through the fingertips descending. And your buttons get pushed and you better figure out, you know, how you're going to fix that. So this is called carpet. Now here's where you get your level of, can I get this, is the sound guy still here? Can I get this lowered a little bit? Thanks. Now here's where you get your level of fame. Here's where your level of fame gets measured, here on the red carpet. The reaction of the photographers, the measure of your popularity when in the presence of other famous people, the reaction of the fans, all of it. You want to know the temperature of your fame? This is the thermometer stuck in your mouth, in the mouth of your fame. This is it. Not that you really want to take its temperature. Shit, you just like the work you do, the acting, the music, whatever. But no choice now. You've stepped onto the carpet. Your thermometer is in. For years, I would only go to an awards show if I was nominated. I never wanted to hear the dreaded, well, what are you doing here? Said nicely or innocently, or can that ever be asked innocently? I don't know. Maybe it's just shitty. A bad, mean thing to say to people. But if I only ever went to an awards show when I was nominated, then I wouldn't be subjected to that, to hearing that question. No chance of somebody taking a pot shot of my, at my level of fame if I'm nominated, right? But I pushed against that here. I went unnominated 3 times. What the fuck? Whatever. I'm at the Independent Spirit Awards. This is 2007, 2009. 3 years, 3 times, like I said. Okay, I'm there. On the red, well, blue carpet. And this thing happens. I don't know which one of the years, maybe all of the years, I don't know. That thing happens that you never, ever want to have happen to you. This is having your fame temperature taken. But instead, you're a baby. And babies can't have their temperatures taken orally. Can't put their glass thermometer in their mouths, have to put it in the butt. So, up the butt, and what if it breaks? Shards of glass, blood, poop, yeah. Well, if you're still here with me, that's what this thing I'm about to tell you is like. Okay, I'm there. After years of frenzied fame, can't go out without people losing their shit fame, it's nice to have it lessened, to now be at the Spirit Awards and be surrounded by an entirely different, wholly based on quality of work fame. Nice. I like being there. My people, if you will. That's what I'm telling myself. It's really the only level of fame that makes sense to me. It's solid, it's wholly connected to the quality of the work. Okay. They're feeling good. Pictures, sure. Pictures snapped. Some people asking for on-camera interviews, most of them not asking. It's okay. I expected that. It's okay. I'm not in any of the films nominated there. I'm not on a TV show, even. I'm writing, producing, digital media, the future of entertainment at the time, and all that. But okay, this thing. Okay. You don't want this. This, now look, don't get your hopes up. I'm not about to tell you that somebody shanked me there on the red, blue carpet. I'm having some pictures taken, still famous enough, I guess, for those pictures to be taken. Respect, okay. Then this thing. Can you just, the gesture, the look with the eyes, gesturing over to a place on the red, blue carpet that's not here. Can you just, from the photographer, you don't even realize what you were doing, what kind of situation you made for yourself when you moved over to this spot on the carpet. The photographer, one arm bent, finger on the camera shutter button, the other arm out like that publicity event handler invitation. He was taking a picture, see? He was taking a picture, and now arm bent, picture taking paused, you're invited to move. You are being invited to move away. You are being invited to move away from where you're currently standing. You just got asked to get the fuck out of the way so the photographer can properly continue taking pictures of a famous person and not you. You are in the way. You are standing too close. You move too close to the famous person and he's trying to take their picture and get out of my fucking shot. Fuck, 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 that. That's what I'm talking about. So no. In the big scheme of things, and children starving in Africa, and being bombed into oblivion in Syria, or you name it country, being attacked by Russia, or the US, or terrorists, and oh shit, are they all just the same category of attackers? No. Not the worst thing that can happen to you. Sure, I know. But you're here to read about fame. Well, that's the glass thermometer breaking in the baby's ass, temperature taking of fame. The butt, and the blood, and the poop moment. That's it.
Thank you. So that's very evocative. I have to tell you, it sounds like you.
That's the whole book. The whole book is like that.
I feel like you must
get the book.
You must. Well, you tell me. Do you read out loud when you're working on a draft of something, or do you speak it before you write it down? Or tell me how that, because it's very conversational and very natural.
Yeah, it depends. When I first started writing this book, when I was in the middle of my my undergrad degree, so this was just a few years ago, because I started university as a freshman at 46. So I started thinking about the subject and this ephemeral mist that comes into a room when a famous person enters and sort of changes the temperature completely, and also about what I mentioned, the around 2000, when the obsession with celebrity sort of exploded. So I started taking notes, and then once I, 2 years later when I graduated, I started writing an academic version. I got halfway through that, and I realized, oh, this needs to be written in a more raw emotional way. So then I just sat down and did nothing but write for 3 weeks, and that's what came out. So it is stream of consciousness, and that is conscious, a conscious choice, of course, because I knew I wanted it to be in this style. I wanted it to be, I wanted to give the reader that feeling of either the almost panicky kind of feeling of like, oh my God, what's happening? I'm not okay. What's going on right now? Oh shit, I wish I was not in this uncomfortable situation right now too. I wanted to, in the arrangement of the words, pass on the feelings of what was going on at the time. And for a lot of it, when the fame was high, you know, the beginning of that life cycle, right up to the equilibrium, for my experience and for you know, other known people too that become famous very quickly and with a very large amount of fame, it's like a fire hose. And it's not like you can be, people say, well, what parts of it did you enjoy? I said, it's not really that kind of experience. I mean, you do enjoy some things while you're in it, but it's more just trying to manage your canoe down the roaring rapids. Like you just like, okay, let's just say, don't want this to capsize. It's not like you can stand arm's length from this fire hose of fame that you're having to manage yourself in and sort of stand at arm's length and take a cup, dip a cup into the water and then like take a sip and kind of enjoy what you're looking at. No, it's like it's coming at you and you're like, okay, I gotta stay up here so I don't drown. So that's what I tried to I tried to pass on the emotions to the reader in the arrangement of the words.
So I have to ask you, I mean, what I love writing is profiles. I love talking to people who I think are special and creative and haven't been written about right. And what that invariably means is prying into their lives. And I mean, you write really well about this moment of time. I think it was during the show Men Behaving Badly,
mm-hmm.
am I right? Where you feel like you broke your rule, whatever that rule was, and you told this writer who, you know, put down his pad and said, look,
right.
I don't want this to just be a puff piece. But here's what I'd like to hear about that. By the same argument, I know you admire different artists and you want to probably understand what makes people tick and what makes things happen. So explain to me what's going on there.
So the part he's talking about in the book is where I say, I'm talking about how you can't control fame. You can only manage yourself in it. And this is probably true of like, I've never been in an enormous, natural disaster. I mean, except for, you know, I live in California, so earthquakes, but, you know, like one where you don't really know you don't really know how you're going to react unless you're in it. And you manage yourself in it as it's happening. And you can't control the thing that's happening. You can only control yourself in it as best you can. So he's talking about a time where the only time I tried to control fame. I tried to sort of ramp it up. And I revealed things about myself that I had not planned on revealing at all. That's what he's referring to. And the way I feel about, there was a New York Times article recently by somebody who does, I forget the name, but some reporter that does...
Taffy wrote that, and it was about Bradley Cooper. Am I right?
No.
Oh, no, wrong one. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So I'm thinking about another one where this man does, I believe it was a man, he does celebrity profiles. Like that's his niche. That's his It's how he pays his rent. And the article was sort of bemoaning the fact that because celebrities have an opportunity to gain so many followers, they have this direct microphone to all of the people that are their fans. He was talking about Taylor Swift. I think she has 100 million, which is equal to almost a third of the population of the United States. This is enormous, right? 100 million Instagram followers. And he was saying, almost resentfully, it seemed, I'm unfairly characterizing him, I know, but that he was almost resentful that he was complaining. I think I could safely say that. He was complaining that she hadn't done a celebrity profile in quite a few years. She'd released music during that time, of course, but it was almost, he felt that
she owed it to America to do it, right?
And he said, because we should be asking the tough questions. And then he also, and he compared to interviews. He talked about Beyonce doing Vogue, and then she had an article interview, kind of interviewing herself. It was like in her own words. And then there was the Paul McCartney, where GQ, we're going to spend 3 days with him, and then he tells him about his, you know, experiences with John Lennon, which I don't know why after all this time we need to know something like that, just my personal opinion. And I feel like there was really no argument made in there. If some celebrity was reading that, there was no way they would, after the end of that interview, go, well, I think you're right. I think I should totally subject myself to whatever, like, completely perhaps inappropriate questions you're going to ask me. I should really subject. I don't think the guy understood that the only reason anyone ever subjected themselves to those kinds of interviews was because there was no other way to reach the fans. I mean, I give perspective, like, in the 80s and 90s, before we had social media, before we really had a consumer-facing internet like we have now, there was no way you depended on all of these journalists to get your opinions out or sort of speak with your fans. And if they would characterize you in a certain way, a way that you didn't want to be characterized, you couldn't do anything about it. So I don't blame anybody who's famous now, because I'm not, but to have someone like Taylor Swift, if she can already talk to 100 million people, why would she subject herself to being asked about, you know, who she dated? And I don't know. It's
Well, what I'd argue to that is, I didn't really like that article, but I hear what you're saying. What I'd argue to that is having an unmediated relationship with your fans is really wonderful, but it's preaching to the choir. And that if you want to actually reach people who might not know what you're
well,
doing.
Maybe, but if she's already got a third of, I mean, I'm not saying all of her followers are American citizens, but if you've already got equal to a third of the population of the United States, you're probably doing fine.
Well, I mean, I guess, but
there's other interviews. There was one. So Kendrick Lamar is a favorite of mine, the musician. And there was an article in, I think it was Vanity Fair, and it didn't get into his private life. It didn't get into asking him the, quote, tough questions that, you know, I don't know, the type of questions the Inquirer would like to, you know, talk about, I guess. It was about his process. And I want to read it again.
Yeah.
Because I can play a couple of instruments. I like listening to music, but I'm not a musician. Like, I don't think that way. And so reading about his, I mean, if more articles like that, or I read a great piece on this one author by a journalist, I forget who, in Paris Match. And that went into, like, historical context of this work and everything, and it was fascinating. So work like that from journalists is great. And I love the media. I love journalists. But it was interesting to read that article and just wonder if the guy was really reading what he was writing, because it was not anything was going to convince
anyone. It seemed very petty.
He wasn't going to convince anyone to subject themselves to me, an in-depth interview is not, let me try and pick out the most embarrassing things you've ever done and really put you on the spot. And
well, I hope no one, I mean, I wouldn't want anyone to do that.
No, but that is what's done. But there are lots of journalists that are not like that at all. And I was saying earlier in the green room that doing press for the book is sort of a meta performance art epilogue to the book, because there are things that I mention in the book about how things can be misconstrued, or how interviews sometimes are, the interviewer will attempt to move the interview in a particular way, which is not not exactly the direction the interview is naturally going in. And I've had some like that, or people asking questions that...
This one?
Well, in the book, and
you
some
can,
of
it's
the,
just us up here.
Some of the interviews that I've done, I almost want to say to them, like, you know, and I could you can take anything and then just spin it. You know, you spin it around to the thing that you wanted to talk about. You know, even someone can say, you know, gosh, well, you know, you're in the red and white striped top. Maybe you've got, you know, a gardening book, and you've developed this incredible, you know, greenhouse architecture, and all these other places are adopting that. And they say, but now tell me about this shirt you're wearing. And you can say, well, it's interesting you ask me that, because the designs of it remind me a lot of the designs that I first thought of when I put these greenhouse designs together. And you just spin it right over to the thing that you want to talk about, regardless of what they've asked. And seeing that we're in a church, I don't know how many of you are Bible readers, but Jesus in the New Testament was one of the best people at that. I don't know if you ever look at that, but if you ever do, no matter what they asked him, he sort of spun it over to what he wanted to ask. And I'm sure there were people walking away from him going, I mean, he didn't really answer my question, did he? I mean, we're all satisfied with what he said because it's really insightful and stuff. But I mean, I don't really feel like I got an answer.
Jesus has not been properly profiled. I'll tell you that. What I say to people who are famous.
He's fine with that.
People who are famous before I want to do a story, what I say to them is I say, here's what I want to do. And if you're cool with that, let's do it. But if you don't want to, let's just not even bother. So I don't really, if I've gotten people will say, well, you can talk to Kate McKinnon, but you can't ask her about her personal life. You can't ask her about her background. You can't ask her about any relationships. Now, I wasn't going to sit down and say, oh, tell me, like, who are you dating right now, you know? But to lay all the rules out like that, I said, well, it sounds like it's going to be kind of like, there are going to be too many rules here. I don't know how we can even have a conversation.
Well, let me ask you then, if you're interviewing someone because, I mean, Kathy McKinnon is an actress.
Kate McKinnon is the Saturday Night Live cast member.
She's an
actress. Yeah.
So if you are doing an interview with her, you want to talk to her about what it is that she does for a living.
Right.
So the publicist didn't name acting as something that you couldn't ask her about, right?
Well, no, but I feel like if there are that many restrictions before you've even met anybody, it's going to be hard to have a normal conversation. I mean, what if you hit a minefield there? Or like, where'd you come from? Well, I can't talk about where I live.
But I would hazard to guess that the reason you're asking, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason you're asking or assuming your readers are going to want to know is because she's famous.
No, it's because I don't want to come into a hotel room with a table and sit with someone who I don't know at all and have a 45-minute conversation and think that that can be of value to the person and, more importantly, to our readers. I want to find out that Ava DuVernay, who we profiled in the Washington Post, I spent 10 different interview times over a year and a half doing that, because I feel like to understand somebody, I mean, we barely know each other, mm-hmm. You know, I think we're getting along okay, but imagine if we had spoken 4 or 5 times before this, it would be a different conversation.
Maybe.
You know, and I'm not going to ask you about dating habits or where you live. I just,
okay.
I'm interested in the creative process, you know?
One thing I'd love to get into is,
yeah.
One of the things I write about in the book is, and I mentioned it earlier in here, but this sort of obsession that happened to me, it seemed to me it happened around 2000. Like fame, you know, when I was on the show Family Ties that sort of introduced this fame into my life, you had very concentrated audiences. You didn't have 500 cable channels or 800, however many there are now. You didn't have consumer-facing internet. So you really just had the big three TV stations. And then if you wanted to go to the movies, you had to go actually to the movies. And you had to, if you wanted to go to the play video games, you had to go to the arcade. So audiences were really concentrated. There weren't a lot of options. So at our height, well, over the 7 years that the show was on, the average was 27 million or 26 million people watching each week. Sorry, at our height, there's like 55 million people watching. So now I feel though we've So I want to. So I have a bit of the book that I'll read you that is what happened around 2000. Why I think this there was a seismic shift in the our focus on fame in society. If you don't mind.
No, it's your book.
Okay, 2000. I noticed around 2000 there was this seismic shift in the focus of fame. There were by then many more print outlets, TV outlets, cable outlets that needed entertainment-based material. They'd painted themselves into a corner, even, maybe, with the volume of material they needed. Pages and pages and hours of material. The paparazzi population exploded. They were everywhere, and they were anyone. Anyone could be in on it. Not just event photos now, but photos of celebrities everywhere doing anything. We had the perfect storm around 2000. Reality shows were gaining traction around the same time that all these entertainment outlets needed more material. Match made in heaven. You also had society wanting to increase the odds of becoming famous to make new opportunities. Hence the increased popularity of reality shows. So more celebrities means more material for the outlets. So Heidi Montag, The Situation, and so on. I'm sure they're fine people, but who are they? It's like the Chutes and Ladders board game of fame. That's what we've set up in our society. Land on the right square, make the right move, walk the right amount of steps, and you will climb the ladder to the higher position to fame. Make the wrong move, step on the wrong square, and you take the slide way, way down away from fame. We set that up as a society. We set that up and we built the scaffolding that sits underneath those pylons and wood beams under the water, under the pier. We built that together. We watch the 24 hours of entertainment programming on E! We buy InStyle and Entertainment Weekly and Premiere and Us and People and OK and In Touch Weekly and Life in Style. We watch Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and the talk shows in the day and in the night. We read gossip blogs and pass around TMZ videos. We stuff our faces with paparazzi photos of the famous in line at the grocery store consuming it, can't get enough of it, every day. Now, what's that about? Why is that structure, that support mechanism for fame, kept so healthy and strong and robust? We keep it healthy and strong and fed so we can maybe use it someday. Me. If you let it die, the support under fame, you stop feeding it and it will no longer be there for you. If you don't attend to the nail in the wood maintenance of it, of the beams in the water under the pier, it will collapse. And that option for you will utterly disappear. So we keep it healthy. We read the magazines and watch the shows and buy the clothes and the cars the famous wear and drive. We create reality programming even to make the Chutes and Ladders game, board game, even wider, bigger, more squares, more ladders, hell, more slides. Everybody can be famous. More ladders equals more lottery ticket buyers, more chances to win. We keep it healthy, this machine, because someday, just maybe, we hold the hope, someday we might step on that square that holds the bottom of the fame ladder, and we will fly up to another plane, another life, a way out of this one, and we will be hovering above with a bundle of nice stuff. So that is, I believe, what we imagine is going to happen, but it's like, say you're a young woman who really wants to get married, and you look at this relationship these other people are having, and you're like, oh my God, it's look, they have the kids, but they still have date night, and they have this. They do this brunch every Sunday with their good friends, and oh my God, it's perfect. And you look at like maybe six things you know about the relationship, and the two things you really love, you put them up on the shelf, and then you fill in with eight other things you're just sort of making up about their life, and you're just like, oh my God, it's perfect. And you want that. Fame is like that. Fame is, like I said, this like fire hose of stuff that's just happening, this sort of frenzy to fame, and then people assume, oh, you get money and you get accolades and you get work opportunities and you get love. Everybody loves you and all these things. But it's only because they're saying it looks like that. Oh man, it looks like that, and I want that. I want that. And I want that. And then we have all these people on. There's people in the entertainment industry trying to get that. But then, you know, and this is separate to me from just, you know, somebody notices that you're doing work that they like, right? And then we get into social media and like Instagram and...
So can I ask
and,
you...
Well, just to finish this thought. So then we have people even risking their lives or losing their lives by taking some crazy picture at the edge of a cliff because they think it'll get them more followers, and then they fall off the cliff and they die. There's been quite a few instances of that. Yeah.
You said something that made me think about something else in the book, which was you do talk about there is a positive here. I think the term you use is creative identifier, right?
Yeah.
And there is a positive to fame. I mean, it's you know, you want people to feel okay coming up to you and saying, oh, you know what, like, I know that you're in a different place now and all these things, but I loved Mallory, you know? I mean, I don't...
Well, I personally don't want to make them feel okay about that. I mean,
why? Why is that?
But it's not up to me to make them feel okay about that. If they would like to come up and say things like that to people, then...
But you have some very creepy people who've said things to you over the years about that character. But if a 16-year-old girl comes up to you and says, hey, you know what? I was watching on reruns and I saw that character.
Well,
and
a 16-year-old girl is going to read this book before she's going to watch Family Ties. I'm so many years outside of the sort of pop culture background of, like, when I went to UCLA, you know, none of my classmates knew any background on me, which was great. It was fine. I made a lot of great friends. But my professors did, which was terrific, because if there was a crowded class and I was putting in a permission to enroll, you know, I almost always got in, which was great. Because, I mean, maybe, not that I got preferential treatment, I hope, but if they've got a pile of these on their desk, it'll catch their eye. They'll be like, wait, what is... Somebody
but that's a very good point class. You raised, because probably when you were growing up, which was when I was growing up, we didn't have your book, we didn't have Carrie Brownstein's book, we didn't have Amy Poehler's book. These are books that are speaking to people in a different way than we were talked to as kids, really, you know, I would say.
I haven't read those books, so...
Okay. Well, you've read your book.
I've read my
book. I mean,
book.
You know, this is... I can't think of a book from 1985 or 1975 that spoke, you know, would speak in this way,
right?
Well,
some people have said, you know, one friend... was like, oh, this reads just like American Psycho. And I was like, okay, I'll take that. That's awesome.
Leper. That's your, you know, a cat. That's a chapter title. I mean, that's
the chapter title.
So should we be scared to ask you about Mallory?
Well, it's not really relevant to our conversation about, you know, I've said that, you know, playing that character 30 years ago was definitely the fame.
Well, how does it relate to the, I mean, the idea is...
Fame that was attained through playing that character definitely gave me an authoritative foundation upon which to write the book. But to just, and I'm careful in the book to talk about fame rather than career, because that's a whole other sort of path that I've taken. And, you know, it definitely made a turn was made like around 2007 when digital media, you know, I was acting for many years, obviously, and then I was writing, and then the acting doors just started closing, and I didn't really know why, but digital media started happening online, and I was like, oh my God, this is what I was born for. And I started writing and producing and speaking on panels and everything for digital media, and then did that for like 4 or 5 years, and then said, wow, I really want to circumnavigate these people that are like, oh, this, I don't know, it's like 4 years ahead. And I'm like, no, it's here right now. So I was like, I'll go get a computer science degree and go about it that way. It was just...
Can I ask you one thing? Because we have to take questions.
That'd be
great.
Very
important. But one thing I want to ask you is, so, you know, I saw your short 5 minutes.
Terrific.
Really well done.
Yeah, I was on Prime. I have two
shorts
on there that I
directed. It's very
easy
to see, you know? Uh-huh. It's wonderful. To me, I took it as the message it delivered to me was how little people listen to each other. They really don't, I mean, basically. But how do you broker the idea that you're making this fine piece of art? You wrote and directed that, produced it too.
Yeah.
But you have this other area that is famous, right, from this one time period. And do you say, oh, I want to try to leverage that somehow into getting this thing done more easily or make people know, you know? Or do you think about that or no?
No, well, it's, you know, if people, you know, like, just look at, like, the people that happen to follow me on Twitter. I mean, I follow people on Twitter because I like what they have to say. So there's a group of people that like what I have to say, I guess. Hmm. And so I definitely use that to my advantage if, you know, when that film short 5 minutes came out on Amazon Prime and there's another one called Push, I definitely let everyone know. And it's terrific if they were like, you know, they enjoyed, you know, the TV show I did, you know, from 16 to 21 or any of the plays that I did, anything that I did as I was acting, they enjoyed that and they're enjoying this and that's great, you know, that's, but that's almost none of my business. Like, whatever they enjoyed of whatever I've done in my life, it's fine. I mean, I don't certainly, I don't walk around. I live, I don't know if it's just because of the kind of person I am, but I very much live in the moment. I don't, like if someone were to say, tell me what your senior year in high school was like, I'm like, oh, I don't know. I mean, I would really have to sit down and think about that because I'm so, so excited about what's going on right now in my life. I mean, my second book is going to be about, is called Face, and it's going to be about women's faces aging in the public eye.
It's a great subject.
And why that makes the public so angry. And so I'll be directing a film that I wrote with Olivia Munn and Justin Theroux. So I'm really excited about the things that are going on right now. So I don't think about if somebody may know or not know some work that I did 30 years ago.
Okay, so let's get some questions in.
Terrific.
And by the way, after we're done with questions, Justine is going to kindly sign copies of her book in the chapel, which is right through
and
those
doors. I don't know where my stickers went. Who has the fame stickers?
They've probably been all consumed.
Did you guys get them?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
So the microphone is right here in the center. You can go there and sir, question.
Hi. I'm wondering how people who are famous but are also talented can get the focus on their talent. I had a bad experience after a play. The actors who are famous were very nice to stay afterwards and talk to people in the audience. So I'm thinking, oh, great, talented people are talking about their craft.
Mm.
And instead it's like, oh, I interviewed you back when, and do you miss being on this TV show? Like, how can somebody manage that?
How does somebody, what was the last
like how?
How does someone manage that?
Like, how could that have gone better? How do you prevent fans from sabotaging a real creative, talking to your
opportunity,
fans about your work?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's a couple of things you're making me think of. First of all, there was a Jonah Hill as a promotional, as a means to promote his new film that he directed. I think it's called Mid-90s. He's interviewing a series of people, and one of the people he interviewed was Michael Cera. And Michael Cera, I didn't read the whole interview, but the pieces that they had in this article talked about his incredible success from Superbad and how famous he was there, and people around him wanted him to continue that sort of thing, and he really, and this takes a lot of will, he really pushed away from that and said, no, I really want to work with these specific directors, do these creative pieces. So that's kind of an example of what you're talking about. And then the other one is like, wow, sometimes for the performers, sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. And you don't know who's going to be in the audience, or you don't know who you're going to be doing an interview with. And sometimes you'll get someone who really is asking, great intellectual conversations or questions that you can, get into a great conversation with. And sometimes they do that other thing. And when they do that other thing, when they ask these other things, you just got to spin it. Like, she's gone now, but the lady with the example I gave with the lady with the striped shirt. So you just have to try and spin it. And then sometimes you have somebody like yourself in the audience who's like, wow, I really want to hear about the craft. But thanks for your question.
You're welcome.
Hi, Justine.
Hi.
My name is John. I'm an editor for Wikipedia.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
One of 6,000 people who edit all the time.
Yes, thank you. Much appreciated.
Thank you for your work on net neutrality. And I was just wondering, have you ever read your article, and is there any incorrect information?
Oh, my article? Well, I had one.
You weren't in The Who, were you?
No. Yeah. I had one experience where there was this guy who had added in there that he and I had some relationship. And I would go and take it out. And then he would add it back in. And then this happened a couple of times. And then I contacted, I forget how I got some sort of contact to one of yourselves, one of the sort of, one of the fine editors that maintains this. And And they fixed it. I was so glad about it. And it's briefly mentioned in there. It's just like part of a sentence I say, you know. Or they say they used to date you or something, and they didn't. But thank you for all of your work.
Well, you're the only person on Earth who can't edit your Wikipedia article.
I have.
By rules of Wikipedia.
I somehow have gotten away with it.
Just keep that between us.
Pardon
me? Okay? Just keep that in this room.
Yes. Last question. Fame is an interesting thing on Wikipedia because I think, did you hear about the woman who won the Nobel Prize this past week? Oh. She had a Wikipedia article and it was taken down. Most Wikipedia editors are males and young males, and someone who has a TV program can have a page, but someone who's a professor who has done amazing things in physics can't have one.
Because there's a thing called notability.
You have to be written about in certain number of periodicals before you can have a page.
But
every Playboy, Playmate can have a page.
Interesting.
Porn stars can have a page, but
that's quite interesting.
Professors can't.
Wow, thanks for that info. And thanks for your continued work.
Thank you.
Anybody else? I mean, you can even pass that mic around if you want, if you don't want to get up and stand in the middle of the church to
Actually,
ask your question.
It feels good to stand up after being in a pew for a long time. Hi.
Sitting in the pew
for a long time.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about your origin of your fame. Like, did you go to your parents and say, I would like to be an actress, I'd like to be on TV, or did they suggest it? Like, how did it start, and when did you realize that you were different than any other little girl?
Yeah. Well, it was, it was in the 80s, and even though we were living in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, we weren't really surrounded by, celebrity or entertainment business or anything like that. My brother had decided he was going to be an actor. I'm going to be famous, but just we had a neighbor who was an adult who was going to an audition where there was a father-son thing, so my brother went with him. He was like 9, maybe, or 12, I can't remember. And he got that, so he worked for about a year. He became a semi-regular on Little House on the Prairie. And then my mom said, why don't you do it just for the hell of it? And I was like, do what? I mean, I was like, it had never crossed my mind ever to act or anything. And I went, and his agent started sending me out. So within 4 months, I had 2 commercials and the pilot for Family Ties, the first show for Family Ties. So I had no idea. I just sort of fell into my vocation and my vocation for a time there, and then it changed over to writing, producing, and directing. But I had no idea. So there was no time before that where I was saying, oh, I'd really love to act. I wonder if that'll ever happen. Or I'd really love to be recognized for my acting work. I wonder if that'll ever happen. Never crossed my mind. And then as far as, when did I realize, like, oh, wow, this is out of control, was probably the first time I went to a mall. I mean, the first time I noticed it was probably in a mall, because you just couldn't be there without it. Everybody sort of, it was like this magnet, and you're like, oh, my God, I got to get out of here. And not like, hey, we really like your show, but like the oh, my God, it just feels like, it feels like a completely unmanageable situation that you don't feel like you're going to get any help with, because even if you were to go to like the security guard or something like that, they'd also go, oh, but you're that girl. And you'd just be like, oh, my God, I'm completely alone, and something could happen, and everybody would just be like, But these are your fans. There wouldn't be a sense of, like, this could be possibly a dangerous situation. Thanks for your question.
How's it going?
Hi.
So randomly, we just stumbled upon this. So I have not read your book, I'm going to be honest. But I caught a part of your talk where you said, like, the cycle of fame and how there's this new surgence of reality and new celebrities. How do you see fame in 10 years from now, and will there become a point when the fame cycle burns out, and how do you sustain it, or will it be sustained with the way things are going?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Maybe you guys have some ideas about that. I hope this book will sort of jumpstart the conversation and help people to put it in its proper place. In fact, there are some garbage cans in New York City. I was just there for a week, and they say, like, put litter in its place. It's written around the side. And I just put fame right over litter, put fame in its place. And I don't know. I think the one of the big problems with us quantifying value with how many followers you got or how famous you are or anything like that, and I feel like it's really reached a high volume now in our society. Two of the problems with that is we're going to devalue other people. Like a friend of mine is a photographer, and she said, let's pretend this is a phone, okay? She said that she'll go to a kind of a work event, and there'll be another photographer, somebody else that works in the entertainment business, and they'll say, you know, and instead of exchanging telephone numbers or email, you know, just say, what's your Instagram handle, which is normal, I mean, nowadays. And you go, sure, okay. So you give it to her. And as she's talking to them and they're putting it in there and they're like, oh, yeah, so were you at the such and such event recently? Yeah, and they're just talking. And then they look her up and then they go, so cool. So we'll stay in touch, okay? And the whole conversation has changed. And she knows it's because they saw how many followers she had. And they decided right there whether or not talking to her was of any worth professionally, not looking at the quality of photos she had on there or anything. So we devalue other people through that, and we devalue ourselves too, right? We'll go, hey, I'm really pretty happy with all, you know, maybe somebody's an amateur photographer and they're putting pictures up there that they're really proud of, and they have, you know, 150 followers or something. That's pretty nice. Get to share it with that many people, right? And then you go look at a buddy's Instagram account, and they're doing, I don't know, taking pictures of the kids' fails or something, and they have like 2,000 followers, and just go like, wait, really? So I think it's an inside job. It's an individual inside job. I feel like we all need to just really, and this is what I get into in the end of the book, really value our own specific basket of skills and talents. And if our basket of skills and talents isn't going to make us famous, fuck it. Like, just, like, to honor ourselves and to allow our society to benefit from our developed skills and talents, you know? Somebody's going to have a skill and talent that is something that's going to get more national or international notice. But for some people, like, I was talking to a guy the other day, and he says, you know, I was like, oh, what do you do? And he says, I work with the homeless. And he says, it's totally my calling or my... He's like, it's what I was meant to do. And I was like, that's rad. Because if he wasn't doing that, look at all these people who'd be missing out on his true skill and talent, you know? If he was pursuing, like, I'm just going to be famous, you know?
Thank you.
Thanks for your question.
All right, everybody. So do we have any more questions? No? Well, I just want to thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And I enjoyed getting a chance to read the book.
Great.
And I recommend you go out there, buy a book, and Justine will sign it.
Of course.
Okay?
Yeah. Thank you.